You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today is Monday, December 13th, and today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with New Hampshire novelist Toby Ball. Toby Ball was born in Washington, D.C., grew up in Syracuse, New York, and attended Trinity College. He has had stints in journalism, including working for Congressional Quarterly as an editor. And education, he says he had one memorable year as a high school social studies teacher. And nonprofits, the Carbon Coalition, among others. He's now the business manager at the Crimes Against Children Research Center and the Family Research Laboratory at the University of New Hampshire. He lives in Durham, New Hampshire, with his wife and two children. I spoke with Toby by Skype last week, and we discussed his new novel, The Vaults, which was published earlier this year by St. Martin's Press. Here is the publisher's summary of the novel, taken from the inside front cover. In a dystopian 1930s America, a chilling series of events leads three men down a path to uncover their city's darkest secret. At the height of the most corrupt administration in the city's history, a mysterious duplicate file is discovered deep within the vaults, a cavernous hall containing all of the municipal criminal justice records of the last 70 years. From here, the story follows Arthur Puskas, the vault's sole hermit-like archivist with an almost mystical faith in a system to which he has devoted his life. Frank Frings, a high-profile investigative journalist with a self-medicating reefer habit. And Ethan Poole, a socialist private eye with a penchant for blackmail. All three men will undertake their own investigations into the dark past and uncertain future of the city, calling into question whether their most basic beliefs can be maintained in a climate of overwhelming corruption and conspiracy. When I spoke with Toby Ball last week, I first asked him to talk a little bit about his writing background.
Basically, my writing background has been, doing it as recreation, going as far back as, you know, writing comic books with friends when, we were 10 or 11. Uh-huh. And, just doing a little bit of creative writing here and there. When we moved up to New Hampshire from Washington, D.C. in 1997 is when I started sort of more seriously, sitting down and actually trying to produce, a work.
Right.
What I did is when we moved up here, I thought maybe this would be a time, because I'm a big reader, to try my hand at it and see, could I produce something?
Right.
And, so I spent some time thinking and looking at websites and reading some books about advice. And I went with I was trying to be topical, and I wrote a book about identity theft.
Oh.
This was in the late 90s. And it was sort of a Patricia Highsmith type, two people kind of circling each other. And then.
So it was fiction. It wasn't nonfiction.
Yeah, it was fiction. And so I did – that was the first thing I wrote, and I sent that out to agents and got a lot of response of, we really like your writing, but this is not the book for us. Send us your next one.
Uh-huh.
And it was sort of at the point where I'd kind of given up on that one that I decided to give it one more shot with something that was a little bit less calculated to try to appeal to, the publishing world.
Right. And what year did you – well, first of all, how long did it take you to write that first book?
That was probably a couple of years.
Okay.
I'm trying to think. It was probably like sort of 1997 to 1999. Okay. I probably wrote four or five drafts in the end.
Uh-huh. And then The Vaults you started working on when?
I started that in 2001. Mm-hmm. And then – there have been so many iterations of it, but
sure.
I probably – the first iteration I finished, I believe, in 2004, and I sent it out to agents at that point. But then there were – there were at least three more drafts after that draft before I finally landed an agent.
Okay. So what inspired you to write The Vaults?
Well, I get there's sort of two answers to that, and one is that I had an idea for two different short stories, and the vaults sort of resulted from combining those two short stories. So I, you know, I had probably two 15-page stories, and I kind of combined them and ended up with a 300-page book. I guess the second place where it came from, which is a question I get asked a lot when I read, is in the mid-1990s, I read an article by Gerald Posner in the New Yorker about the Berlin Document Center, and about which was this huge repository of Nazi files from World War II. And right after German reunification, they were going to turn over – the U.S. had control of them until then. And then after reunification, we were going to turn it over to the Germans, who had much stricter guidelines on who could look at them. And as a result of that, the U.S., I believe it was the Library of Congress, undertook the biggest microfilming effort in history and committed each document onto microfilm.
Oh.
But there's a lot of problems with that because early Nazi party cards, for instance, were dark blue ink on light blue paper. So they just came out as a gray blob when you microfilm them. And there were things like pages that got separated, that if you had the physical pages, you could kind of figure out by grooves and staple holes or what have you, how they fit together. There's different colors of ink were used that you lost on a black and white microfilm. So, you know, I thought that sort of, you know, metadata involved with the actual physical files was pretty interesting. I went back and read that article after the vaults was published because I figured I'd be answering questions like this. And it was interesting, you know, I guess I must have subconsciously remembered some details from this article that found their way into the book without me really thinking about it.
So you didn't refer to the article constantly as you wrote the book?
I went back and found it after I'd been asked that question a couple of times. And I thought, well, you know, I better actually get this article and read it again just so I can give a good answer. And and when I did that, for instance, there's in the book, green ink is a sort of plot point. And it mm-hmm. turns out when I read the article, the only time they mentioned the color of ink was that Himmler apparently used green ink when he was putting marks on documents. So that clearly, for some reason, carried through.
Oh, and isn't it good that did? Because the fact that it's there makes this sort of nice parallel detail from history. So did you put the plot line of the book into the 1930s because of the need for all of the paperwork to be handwritten and for computers not to exist, or are you drawn to that period anyway?
Well, you're basically right in that I couldn't. It had to be pre-computers, so I figured sort of before 1960, and then you know the 30s I think is just a pretty rich time for crime drama. There's a lot mm-hmm. of sort of interesting history and a lot of hopefully the plot and the characters play off of some of the stereotypes from film noir.
Right. I found it interesting, and I think that one of your reviewers said the same thing, that, you know, it very clearly takes place in a certain period, and yet it feels sort of timeless.
I'm glad that people felt that way. I thought that some of the issues that come up in it are not sort of time-stick.
Right.
And that was somewhat intentional. I mean, I tried not to, with this book or my second book, you know, try and overwhelm people with period detail. Mm-hmm. You know, I try and put enough in there so that people feel grounded in a particular time. They're not trying to figure that out. But the idea is not to give you a very detailed portrait of life in a particular year in this particular place.
Right. Well, in reading the book, I felt like your three main characters really balanced each other very well. There's Puskis, who's a quiet, sheltered character, but he is ultimately very brave, and then Frings, who's the journalist with migraines, who self-medicates with his marijuana habit, and I felt like his migraines and his career made him both a hero and a victim at the same time, which was an interesting thing to do with a protagonist. And then Poole is like, he's an investigator, but he blackmails people, and he's got a dark side. And all of these characters had sort of two sides to their personality, and I just found them a really nice balance, all three of them.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I guess I get a little frustrated when I read books with characters who seem too good to be true. And so my thought was to have, protagonists who are basically likable, but did have their drawbacks and things at which they were at least morally conflicted, if not sort of on the wrong side, and realizing that they're on the wrong side of sort of a moral question.
Right. Yeah. And I also sort of like the fact that you didn't have any point of view character who was a cop. it was kind of refreshing. It's like here are three people who are perfectly intelligent and capable of investigating crime, and they aren't cops. So.
Yeah, it's interesting because my second book, which will come out, you know, next fall, has two characters who are cops, but uh-huh. they are, they're so sort of torn by these other aspects of their personalities and lives. In my mind, when I was writing it, what was interesting about them was not them being cops, and that being cops ended up being a struggle based on these other factors that were happening in their lives.
Right.
So that was kind of how I tried to. Again, I think there's a lot of people who write very well about police and about procedure.
Definitely. And yeah,
I didn't need to. You know, I didn't want to be trying to write in that vein. So even when there are police characters, I kind of look at them as being individuals for whom their job happens to be being a cop and some of the responsibilities that come with that.
Yeah, and I don't mean to take anything away from books that are about cops.
Oh, no.
I just thought it was kind of refreshing to come across one that has such a big investigative side to it that isn't, you know, following cops. So it was different. It was interesting. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about developing each of your three main characters, Puskas and Frings and Poole.
Sure. With Puskas, I mean, he kind of came part and parcel with the whole idea of the vaults, you know, the big repository of criminal information. And, you know, when I initially conceived of the story, it was, there'll be this sort of obsessive, detail-oriented person who's really his life revolves around trying to make sense of information and through organizing it, trying to draw inferences, things like that. And so I didn't have to think a whole lot about him. He kind of came along with that part of the story. The other two. It's interesting because it's been a while since I actually did this, but I wanted to, you know, with Frings, I wanted to have a guy who was in some ways, he was a journalist, but was also a public figure, somebody who people would know, who, you know, had kind of a seedy side, but for the most part, was a bit of an ideologue. Felt very strongly about political things,
uh-huh.
was kind of a muckraker. And then, you know, the private eye, who's Poole, you know, again, I was trying to avoid sort of falling into sort of the standard private eye, sort of lone wolf type person.
Sure.
So he's a person who has thrown football games in the past, is very morally conflicted, feels rudderless, and sort of finds his moral rudder with a girlfriend who's a union organizer.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses sort of her ideology to justify doing things like blackmailing businessmen, for instance. I was trying to find ways to go about having an investigation in the story, but not having sort of the traditional the stereotypical characters.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like Puskás came to you sort of, as you say, almost, you know, naturally. I'm wondering if one character was maybe the hardest to develop.
Well, in early versions of the Vaults, I felt as though Frings and Poole were too similar.
Mm.
And one of the things that I really worked on through the different drafts was distinguishing between them, and having to think a little bit harder about, you know, what their goals were,
right.
And what they felt was sort of morally acceptable ways to act. And then so hopefully by the time the final version, you know, actually hit the stores, that they are, you know, very distinct. But I think that was the struggle.
I didn't have any problem discerning which was which while I was reading it. I never had to think, oh, now who did what, you know, because they did seem very separate to me. So I think you got it.
Okay, good.
Well, do you mind reading a little bit from it?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Okay, great, thanks.
The Vaults took up nearly half a city block. Files arranged in shelves, arranged in rows. Files from every case handled in the city for nearly the past century. Files arranged, cross-referenced, and indexed. So complicated and arcane was the system that at any given time only one living person understood. At this time, that person was Arthur Puskás, archivist. He was the fourth archivist, inheriting the position of Gilad Abramowitz, who had gone mad in his final years and died soon after taking his leave of the vaults. Abramowitz had mentored Puskás for the better part of 10 years, explaining, as best his addled mind allowed, the logic behind the system. Even so, it had taken Puskás most of the following decade to truly understand. He was now in his 27th year in the vaults. As happened every day, several times a day, O'Shea, the messenger from headquarters, had brought a list of files to be pulled. Several items on the list were preceded by an asterisk, which meant that Puskás was to pull all cross-reference files as well. Puskás had a file cart that he wheeled down the long aisles, searching for the appropriate shelves. The cart had a loose wheel that squeaked rhythmically with each rotation. Puskás completed his rounds and returned to his desk with the requested files. He opened the files that had been asterisked and took down the numbers of the cross-reference files. He then took the file cart and went to retrieve those files. Each aisle was illuminated at 30-foot intervals by a bare electric light bulb. Every journey consisted of walking from an illuminated area into a more twilight space and then back into illumination. None of the bulbs ever seemed to burn out, and Puskás was vaguely aware that the city sent someone around to check them periodically. Their collective hum was like some primal sound, one that could have emanated from the earth itself. He was at the shelf for the C4583R series, a dimly lit stretch, when he found the two files. He was searching for C4583R series, subseries A132, file 18. It was in the correct location, just after file 17. He put the file in the file cart and, out of habit, checked the next file to make sure that it was file 19. Abramowitz had suggested the method, an episodic way to check on filing accuracy in place of doing periodic audits as Abramowitz's predecessors had done. The files were too voluminous now to make that feasible. Initially, when he saw the adjacent file, file 18, he assumed he had made a mistake and retrieved the wrong file to begin with. He checked the file cart and found that he had in fact taken the correct file. This meant that there were actually two C4583R series, subseries A132, file 18s. Puskás removed the spectacles from the end of his long, thin nose, rolled his head around to loosen his neck, replaced the spectacles, and looked at the files again. Nothing had changed. The two files bore the same label. He opened the one that had been left on the shelf. It was a file for a reef to graph and read. Fact identification number such and such with this particular address and so on. He opened the one in the file cart. Again, the name is Reef to Graph and Read. Same fact number, address, etc. Duplicate files? Puskás could not imagine himself capable of such sloppiness. A puzzle. Puskás put the second file in the file cart and returned to his desk to address this vexing problem. Puskás took the two folders and with his skeletal fingers laid them on opposite sides of his barren desk. He removed the contents one by one, first from the file folder on his left and then from the one on his right. Prescott had, from years of experience, acquired an especially keen sense of paper of various ages. He would have told an inquisitive soul, if he ever actually interacted with one, that it was an instinct. The truth was that it was an acute understanding of the paper stocks of different decades and the effect that aging had on them, making them dry, crisp, and discolored, but each stock in a minutely unique way. He noticed that the papers from the two files were not of identical age. The paper from the file to his right was not 8 years old, too moist. It bent limply in his fingers without the rigidity that crept into older paper. Taking a greater interest now, Puskas estimated the paper on the right to be 3 or 4 years old. He held the more recent paper up to the light to confirm this estimate. The department's paper supplier for years had been Ribisi and Porfiro. They had imprinted their paper with a distinctive seahorse watermark. 5 years ago, however, they had been acquired by Capital Industries, and to cut costs, the corporation had done away with the watermark. The more recent sample, then, bearing no watermark, must have been created in the last 5 years. Puskas checked the paper from the older file, and as he suspected, it carried the watermark. Somebody had typed the more recent pages at least 2 or 3 years after the original file had been created. It was curious. Also curious were the pages. Same cover sheet, same personal information, same testimony. De Graffenried had been on trial for the murder of someone named Ellis Prosnicki. Same verdict, guilty. The sentence had been life-PN, which was not the approved abbreviation for penitentiary. Just another vexing detail of the unthinkable duplication that Puskas had discovered. Yet here, too, was an interesting difference. In the margin of page 8 of the testimony was a handwritten notation. It read, "Do not contact, Dersh." An arrow pointed to the name Farrell Basu, who was mentioned by De Graffenried as the man who had introduced him to Prosnicki. In the file to the right, it was written in green ink. In the file to the left, the ink was blue. He looked closer. The writing was nearly identical, but not quite. Where the ends tailed off in the blue ink, they ended suddenly in the green. The angles at which the arrows were drawn, too, were slightly different. It was, he decided, as if someone had deliberately copied the notation from one file to the other as exactly as he could, or not quite as exactly. He studied the two notations, trying to discern the forger's intention, before eventually conceding that, from the scant available evidence, this was unknowable. Finally, he came to the photographs. The photo from the left-hand side, the older file, was a head-and-shoulder shot of a man with sunken eyes, a blunt, crooked nose, and receding hair. His mouth slightly open, providing a glimpse of crooked and broken teeth. It might have been cropped from a mugshot. The photo from the file on the right was of a completely different person. This man had long, thin features, hollow cheeks that he had tried to conceal with extensive sideburns, and sparse hair parted in the middle. Most striking to Puskas was the man's stare, as though unaware of the camera, which could not have been more than 10 feet away. It was, Puskas thought, haunting. This was a troubling development. Puskas picked up his phone and, for the first time in over a decade, dialed out.
Thank you very much for reading that. I really enjoy this opening. It really pulled me into the book. And one thing that I just noticed when you were reading it now, which I didn't pick up on the first time through, but it says that if an inquisitive soul had asked him, and then it goes into this aside that says, if he ever interacted with one, which indicates that he doesn't feel that he interacts with inquisitive souls. And I actually think that's a really nice tell about his personality and his character. And in fact, the reason that there are two files, which I won't give away right now, but the reason that there are two files is designed around the fact that he is an inquisitive person and that he is going to want to figure this out.
Right. With Puskas, you know, he's very isolated, and he really, his sort of intellectual and emotional life is bound up in this information. When he sees that something is amiss there, it sort of gets at his core, and sort of compels him to try and find out what's behind it, because it's impeaching his sense of his own sort of competence in, you know, the meaning of his life, basically.
Right. It eats away at the whole reason that he's comfortable in a job like this, which is that he's a very detail-oriented person. He wants everything to be exactly lined up in the right way.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious, Toby, when you set out to write this book, how much did you know about the events in the plot line? Did you know what was going to happen? Or?
That's an interesting question. I certainly knew what the sort of underlying plot was, and I had some ideas. I had some certain benchmarks that I was going to hit. But I've found that when I'm actually writing a chapter or a scene, things kind of occur to you or seem like as though they would logically follow, that when you're just kind of, you know, mapping something out in your mind or on paper, you know, at least for me, I can't think to that level of detail so that things kind of flow logically. So I would say, you know, there's probably about the most important quarter of the plot I probably had generally in mind, but about three quarters of it kind of came as I went along.
Yeah. Okay. That's and that makes for a more interesting read for the reader too, I think, because if it's a surprise to you as you write it, then that sense of discovery will come through more strongly in the writing.
Well, I'll tell you, right now I'm working on my third book, and you know, after you've had your first book published, you no longer have to deliver a finished manuscript for people to, you know, give you an offer of an advance. Mm-hmm. So what you have to do is give a proposal, which is essentially, you know, 50 pages or so, and then a detailed outline of the rest of the book. And I'd never done an outline before. And so in preparation for putting in this proposal, I did write a detailed outline of, you know, the second 90% of this book that I'm writing. And I found it incredibly difficult. And then when I was done, I found that it absolutely stunted the entire book. It just it was just very wooden. I found that I sat down to write, and the first thing I would do is look at the outline and say, oh, what am I supposed to write today? Oh, okay. And then I'd start writing it, and it just, you know, it just seemed very, very flat. It didn't flow. So then I put away the outline, and I still sort of subconsciously I kept thinking, okay, what's next again? What's next again? And so I kind of went through this process of sort of forgetting, you know, dismissing that entire outline and all the sort of plot points I had in there.
Right.
And sort of starting again. And this has been much more successful. And sort of one of the consequences of that is that I've not, you know, I haven't submitted a proposal because I, you know, I basically scrapped that outline. So I'm just writing the book now. So it probably will not go to an editor till the book is basically done pretty close to being done.
Yeah, I remember interviewing someone about a nonfiction book that they had written and asking them about the process of making proposals for nonfiction books and what happens if it changes. And in that case, I guess that if things change, usually it's not a problem as long as it's a competent book. But with fiction, I imagine it would be a big deal.
Well, you know, because I haven't actually run into it, I can't comment from experience, but having talked to, you know, people about it, including my agent, they say as long as you're delivering basically the book that you said you would deliver,
right,
that, you know, straying somewhat from the outline is not that big a deal.
Now you have another job, right?
Yeah.
You still work full time in that other position?
Yes, I'm the program manager for a couple of research institutes at the University of New Hampshire, and they study family violence and crimes against children. I don't run any of the actual research projects, but I, you know, help with writing grants, budgets, personnel management, you know, dealings with the university and the federal government, which is where we get most of our money, things like that.
So do you find it hard to make time to write?
You know, my day is pretty scheduled. And that when I've got two children, a 5-year-old and a 13-year-old, and when the 5-year-old goes to bed, you know, I start to write, and I write from 8 to 10 at night, probably 5 or 6 nights a week.
Okay.
So it's very regimented.
Uh-huh. And actually, now you're mentioning what you do for a living reminds me of the article on violence that you wrote in a recent publisher's weekly. And you mentioned in that article having been interested to describe in your own book, The Vaults, violent acts only when you really had to and not linger on them. And I think that part of that has to do with your work. Can you talk a little bit about that article?
Sure. The article was essentially talking about sort of a trend towards, real horrific violence in genre novels, particularly mysteries and suspense novels. And my issue and my question is, why has that become a new, why is there a new standard for that very popular books, which in a genre which in the past, you know, would certainly deal with violence and the aftermath and you know, personal pain and things like that. Why is it necessary now to have the violence be so extreme and to have the descriptions of it be so graphically rendered, mm-hmm. when in the past, you know, letting people, you know, use their imagination or some inference or in some other way other than, you know, just very detailed description of what is happening to somebody, convey sort of the horror of the violence. I don't want to sound as though I'm prudish about this. There's certain authors who are out now who I feel are really good writers and whose books I very much enjoy, but then have scenes of violence that I would certainly not want my kids reading, and that I feel sort of uncomfortable reading myself, and then even more uncomfortable about why is this being written, and why is this something that a decision's been made would appeal to a mass audience? Mm-hmm. So I guess that's basically the thrust of the article, is sort of asking why is this trend there, and isn't it, you know, doesn't it make sense to ratchet that back a little bit? And I sort of end with talking about, I think, the most famous sort of scene of, you know, suspense horror is the shower scene in Psycho, where you don't actually see any violence. It's all inferred from, you know, you see Norman Bates, you see the blood running down the bathtub, and you know, it's easy to put together what's happened. But you know, it stuck with you for a reason, and that was, I guess that's kind of the art of it. But that's, you know, so much more famous than, you know, things that you would see in Saw or some of these other, you know, ultra graphic, ultra violent movies.
Right.
And I think there are sort of subgenres, literary subgenres in horror in particular, that are sort of the whole point is this extreme violence, and you know, and that's fine. I guess my issue is more with it creeping into books that people who aren't necessarily interested or looking for that particular thing would be reading, and then coming across this.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. You know, what occurs to me while you're speaking is that there are a number of books I would love to recommend to certain people, and in fact, I won't do that because I know that the people I'm thinking of would be completely turned off by just a single scene in the book, you know, and it'll be such an issue for them that they wouldn't enjoy the book. And you know, maybe that doesn't apply to everybody. And in fact, I was able to enjoy the book, despite there are some people that won't be able to, and it's too bad that that's always there.
Right. There are several books that, you know, I could recommend to people if I could redact, you know, a few pages or a paragraph or something, but you know, you can't. So sometimes I recommend them and just forewarn.
Well, I have a question then, another question about The Vaults that actually doesn't relate specifically to violence, but you have a couple of, I think, strong women characters in this book. Carla, you mentioned. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about writing about women and minorities, writing about them in a certain time period that's long past, but from a contemporary perspective. And specifically what made me think of this is that I do think these are strong women characters, but they would have been up against the system back then.
Mm-hmm.
And Carla in particular being a union leader or helping with the union. Just writing about women, you know, from those two perspectives kind of battling each other.
I think in this book, and again in my in the next book that will be coming out in a few months, I didn't want to have characters or classes of characters who, you know, were just victims or who were unable to act in their own defense, you know. And I think the two women are quite different, whereas one whose life really is as a union organizer and who has very strong political views and has quite a bit of courage in acting to further these views. And so she's sort of taken that choice with her life. Whereas with Nora, you know, she's a jazz singer and, you know, something happens to her and she's put in a position where, you know, she can either sort of passively accept what's happened or try and do something about it. And it's sort of my conception of both these women are women who are not the type of person who will sit back and let things happen around them that they oppose and just let that go, that they have to step forward. And so I think in two very different ways, one of them chosen sort of a life path to address that, and another one is put into that, into a situation
right.
that they do that. And as far as trying to work it out for the period, you know, with Carla, who's the union organizer, I mean, she's really sort of a behind-the-scenes person. You know, in later years, she'd probably be more out front. But in the 30s, she's really working behind the scenes to help men get their acts together and find courage. And then with Nora, I mean, it's a consequence of something that happens to her. It's not something that she seeks out.
Right. And I don't want to give away anything too much. I've just thought that it was interesting that you were able to depict them in a realistic way for the time period and yet give them a sort of... well, and I'm sure there were very strong women in the 30s that were up against problems, you know, that they had to deal with. So,
this comes more into play in my second book, which has a lot of African American and racist elements to it, is really not wanting to fall into the trap of having, you know, a savior who rides into town on his white horse. It makes everything better for mm-hmm. people who can't do it for themselves. So again, with whether it's women, it's racial minorities, whatever. I heard a discussion about this around the movie Mississippi Burning, where there was a certain amount of, you know, anger and disappointment that essentially the movie was set up where you had these African American victims who are saved by these two white Northerners come and basically make everything okay for them. It sets up a strange dynamic in that there's nobody who can, you know, fight back against these racist white Southerners, but other white guys, and sort of disempowering the African Americans who are in the movie and who, you know, in reality were absolutely crucial in the civil rights. I mean, they were Africans were the leaders in that movement.
Yeah.
So trying not to fall into that trap and being very but being very deliberate about having everybody in the book having motivations, having things that they want to do. And this includes the villains more or less. And taking actions on their own impetus to achieve their goals or defend themselves. I think that's whether it's the main characters or side characters or people with power or people without power, they're all acting in their own self-interest and are not passively letting things happen to them.
Okay, great. I love your characters' names. They're all fabulous. And I wonder if you struggle coming up with great character names.
You know, it's funny because I get asked this question quite a bit. And the answer is I take a look at the rosters of international soccer teams and kind of mine them for interesting sounding names. So if you follow, you know, world soccer, a lot of the characters' last names will be familiar.
Oh, that's so funny.
And some of them are more obscure, but, you know, Frings, for instance, there's a German soccer player named Torsten Frings, and that's where that name comes from.
That's wonderful, because then you'll have all different backgrounds represented and everything, because the soccer world is the whole world. That's awesome.
Right. And I grew up in Syracuse, which is a very sort of ethnically diverse city, and a lot of people from Eastern Europe and different Eastern European countries. And when I was sort of envisioning the city, that was part of what I was envisioning, is sort of this mix of immigrants from different countries and wanting to sort of provide a subliminal sense of that richness of the environment there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I did read that you said that the city in the vaults is sort of to Chicago what Gotham is to New York.
Yeah, you know, that wasn't actually me.
Oh, that's not you?
It's interesting. Different people have taken different, make different assumptions about what I'm basing it on. So that was somebody else, and I sort of laughed and told them that, you know, I've actually never been to Chicago except for going to O'Hare Airport. So, yeah, you know, different people, like, sort of have different conceptions of it. You know, I've had people mention Pittsburgh, you know, so in my mind, I wasn't trying to model it after anything. When I was making the decision to have a anonymous city, it really came down to, you know, when people have to sort of the suspension of disbelief, is it easier to suspend your disbelief about a completely anonymous city where that makes no claim to being a specific historical place? Is it harder to suspend disbelief about that? Or if I had said it in Chicago, can you swallow the fact that there are all these details that are not going to be right?
Yeah.
Where a lot of the stuff that happens in the book, I don't think you could point to this city or that city. And I thought that might be jarring enough that just having it be a fictional anonymous city, you don't have people trying to sort of meld it into what their understanding of a specific place's history would
yeah.
be.
Okay, so I do have one last question for you. And that, you mentioned earlier having, you know, finished your first novel and tried to find an agent and not having succeeded, and then, you know, putting it on the shelf and starting over. And this time you did find an agent. Can you talk a little bit about finding your agent?
Sure. With The Vaults, there's really two big rounds of trying to find an agent. And the first one was unsuccessful, and I sent it out to a number, probably 36 agents. Got a lot of full manuscripts read, and they said we liked the writing, but we're just, you know, don't love it enough to represent it. And I'd actually sort of given up on it, and then the first Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award contest came up, and I entered it in that sort of on a whim and ended up doing well in that contest, and also kind of seeing, you know, what other people were writing and sort of identifying, you know, things in these other excerpts that I also found in my excerpt that I thought could be improved, and just sort of seeing what other people were writing and using that to inform another rewrite of The Vaults. And at that point, I submitted again to agents and ended up with an agent who's just been great, former editor who I work with very hard on the manuscripts before they're even submitted to editors. But that was the real key. I signed with my agent in late July, and I signed a contract with St. Martin's in early October.
And that's in 2009?
That was in 2008.
Oh, 2008. Yeah, when did this come out?
It took 2 years for the book to come out. Yeah.
Oh, all right. Okay. And so the Amazon – tell me again, the contest was the –
It's the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award contest, and it's been run, I think, annually. I mean, I haven't paid as much attention since I'm not sort of in it at this point, but there were, I can't remember if it was 2,000 or 5,000 at that point, but you'd enter your manuscript and post the first 30 pages, and people could read each other's 30 pages and you know, write reviews and things like that. And it still goes on. I know there was one last year. I don't know if there's one coming up or not. But the winner gets a publishing contract.
And you said that you did pretty well. So did you place?
The final 100 out
of
2,000 or 5,000.
Yeah.
But not the final 10. So it was sort of the second to last cut.
Uh-huh. Well, that's great.
But it was great. I mean, it's a good, you know, and if other people are writing and just, you know, want to get some feedback from people who you don't know, I certainly found that to be a valuable thing in that contest, was hearing what people who I didn't, you know, already have sort of a personal relationship with would have to say about what they read.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Toby, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you.
That, again, was a conversation with Toby Ball, author of The Vaults, published by St. Martin's Press. More information about Toby Ball and his work is available on the website, tobyball.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by my guest's novel, The Vaults. In our conversation, Toby Ball mentioned his decision to create an unidentifiable city in which to base his story. And this week, study the setting of your book and decide to what extent it is identifiable and if the geography of your work conveys all that you would like it to convey. Perhaps, like Toby, you'd rather the place in your present piece not be specifically identifiable with roads and highways that you would find in your Garmin. Or maybe place is vital to your work and you need to study the way you've presented it on the page and see if it adequately represents the real thing if you want it to. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes, and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. Feel free to leave suggestions there if you have any, or feedback about the show. And you can check out upcoming shows by looking at my blog. it needs to be updated. But the blog is at writethebook.wordpress.com, and I should be updating that soon. A reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send me an email. You'll notice that we only had Bookworm's calendar events from a couple of different places this week. I'm happy to read other events if you've got them coming up. If you're an author or a library, a bookstore, let me know what you've got going on. Send that email to writethebook@gmail.com. And please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about the station is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby will be here to bring you the world of music at 3 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.